In Session with Dr. Farid Holakwi.
Good evening, welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Farid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next hour here on Radio Hamra. Studio number to call in, 310-441-0555. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show or suggest topics or books for the program. And the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Let's get to the books of the week. The book of the week for this week that I'll talk about on next Monday's show is What Life Should Mean to You by Alfred Adler. What Life Should Mean to You by Alfred Adler. Alfred Adler is one of the a big name in the field of psychology, psychoanalysis. And I wanted to read a book directly by him. Of course, I've read a lot of excerpts from him and his work and his ideas. But in the books, The Courage to be Disliked, which I read a few years ago, still my favorite title of any book I've read, probably ever, but definitely in these last 6 years. And it also was a very good book. And then the follow-up to that, which I read this year, The Courage to be Happy, which both of those books revolved around the work of Alfred Adler and Adlerian psychology. And so I thought, why not go to the source and read more directly from some of his work? And so I came across this book, What Life Should Mean to You, by Alfred Adler. Look forward to reading and sharing with you next week. The book of the week from last week that I'll be talking about tonight is Little Treatments, Big Effects by Jessica Schleider. Little Treatments, Big Effects, How to Build Meaningful Moments That Can Transform Your Mental Health. And this book gave me some mixed feelings from the outset, because a theme in the book is that single session interventions, basically single therapy sessions, can be very helpful to individuals and can make lasting changes, or even, as it says, transform. I also have generally a dislike of the word transform when it's used in therapy or in self-help classes or books, or this idea of transforming yourself. And it doesn't mean I don't believe in change. I absolutely do. But sometimes that word transform usually comes with this idea of very quick and extreme types of changes, and becoming sometimes superhuman or not human being the goal. Doesn't always have to be, but that's my own experience with that word being used in psychology, self-help, that realm. So, yeah, I had some of those hesitations about the book. And of course, because of that the book is talking about single session interventions, or that's a theme. It's also just talking about small moments that can be transformative or lead to change in individuals. But therapy, and in the world of psychology, you generally will hear psychologists, therapists talk about how therapy takes a long time. I've said that so many times here on the show and outside of the show, because it's something I believe and have believed for a long time, that generally you need many sessions and it does take time to make significant changes. So this is a type of just accepted truth in the world of therapy. But here, this book is challenging that, and it's not just this book. There's a whole field of looking at single session interventions, challenging this notion that therapy has to take a long time, or needs to take a long time. Now, I should add, she makes it very clear in the book that it's not that she's suggesting we don't need any long-term therapy or any type of intensive treatments. We only need single session interventions. That's not what she says. She says it several times throughout the book that one single session interventions won't be for anyone, just like no treatment is for everyone and will help everyone. And also that it by no means is supposed to replace other forms of treatment that are out there. So that I could definitely resonate with much more and made sense to me. But she shares in the book that these types of single session interventions have been around for a while. I mean, she even says that we see historically early instances, I think even in the work of Freud or others, that a single session became very curative or made a huge impact. Often in those cases, it wasn't planned to be single session, so that's different. But still, that a single session could have led to a meaningful change, so that's not new. But also she adds that there has been decades of research looking at this more specifically, at single sessions, and can they be helpful to individuals? And there's a lot of research that she talks about in the book that does show exactly that, that it can be very helpful for individuals to get a single session of therapy, or even sometimes it doesn't have to be therapy with a therapist. It could be something they do on their own or with a professional or even a volunteer who can guide them through the material. So taking a step back, she sets the context, which I thought she did really well, of looking at the field of mental health, or the area of mental health, and how it is so hard to get help. You know, we talk so much about seeking help and the barrier there is there of people just even wanting to seek help. I was joined last week on Friday, Dr. Pauline Yeknazar-Peck, and we talked about mental health awareness and also how people have, you know, these stigmas that keep them from opening up to others, but then seeking treatment, which is very true. And so that's one huge barrier, those stigmas and people's not feeling okay about getting help from a psychologist, psychiatrist, any kind of mental health professional. However, there's also another huge barrier, which is even if you want help, trying to find that help is not that easy. First, people don't know where to look. You know, you might Google and come across some people or some names, or maybe you'll find a site like Psychology Today and find some people. But in general, people can have a hard time finding individuals. Then within those, if you have insurance, seeing someone who, or finding someone who takes your insurance, and then that person being available or being having an opening that they can see you soon, and then financial barriers, time barriers. So there's lots of things that get in the way where people who, although they want help, have barriers to accessing help, including those things that I just mentioned there. And so that is a big problem. And she cites, one statistic that I thought was really, I mentioned this on last Friday's show because I'd read it just that day, I think, but is that something like 80% of people, this is based on population statistics, 80% of people at some point in their life will meet the criteria for a mental disorder. So, you know, sometimes you think, 30%, 40%, no, but 80% of people will meet a criteria for mental illness at some point in their lifetime. So that could mean you had a depressive episode or met the criteria for depression one time in your life, even would add you to this list, including individuals who might have more chronic disorders or illnesses that they are struggling with, 80%. So that's 4 out of 5 people, almost everyone. I would definitely put myself as part of that 80%. And even if you're not, you're in that lucky 20%, you still almost definitely know someone, and actually many people, who would meet the criteria for mental illness. So it's not something that is distant or affects just a few people. It is practically affecting everyone directly, and everyone definitely indirectly will be affected by it. So there is a need, and unfortunately, there just isn't enough help out there, in the sense that it is hard to find someone. So I don't want to discourage anyone. You can find help. Look for it, and you can find it, but it can be difficult to find. So in a way, these single session interventions can help fill some of that gap, that there's so many people that won't be able to find a therapist and find the help that they need. Or even as she talks about programs where when people are on a wait list, they can give them these single session interventions in that meantime, so that at least things possibly don't get worse, or that they can get better in that time while they're waiting. And so that can be really a great benefit. And I think that she presented information well, in the sense that it was not, this is a panacea, that single session interventions are going to eliminate mental illness forever, or that's all that we need, or it's going to fix everything. She didn't say that, but she did say that it's something that is quite overlooked and underfunded and really just not even known about. And so I would have to acknowledge you mentioned in the book about training therapists and people, you know, the education that therapists go through. And I didn't have anything on single session interventions that I, in my PhD program. I did have some things on short-term types of therapy, short-term dynamic, psychodynamic therapy, short-term couples therapy, never single sessions, but shorter term, which maybe would be 8 sessions, 12 sessions, maybe sometimes less. But we hadn't seen, or I didn't see this in my studies of single session intervention. So she's right about that. There's a lack of knowledge of even the possibility of this. So that's something very important. She also talks about when we look at treatments, and this is something we always have to be aware of for any type of treatment, but definitely in psychological research, we might say something works, but what does that mean? And so she says there's two types of factors we want to look at. One is clinical effectiveness, and one is treatment acceptability. So clinical effectiveness is essentially looking at, do people get helped with this treatment? So people are depressed, they get this treatment, they feel better. That would mean that it's clinically effective. It is helping them with their problem. But we can't ignore treatment acceptability, which is what is the experience like for the client, but also how accessible is it? So if we say there's this treatment for depression, but it costs $150,000 and takes daily sessions for 6 months, well, not everyone or very few people will be able to afford that. So although it might be an effective treatment, how acceptable is it, and how really, what's the validity in that sense, or the effectiveness in that sense is very low. How many people can actually benefit from this treatment? It might not be many people at all. So I thought that was important to note that. And that's something that we do see in psychotherapy. And actually with Dr. Yair Nazar-Peck, we talked a bit after the show, and that was something that came up about how therapy, weekly therapy sessions, is not something that many people can afford, especially in the United States. It becomes limited because most insurance doesn't cover, or limited coverage of therapy sessions, depending on your coverage and depending on your therapist. So there definitely is other gaps in how we treat people when it comes to mental illness that are definitely, you know, a big problem. So she shares about the single session interventions. And at the end of the book, there are examples of the exercises, because as I was mentioning before, you can do them with a therapist, but also they can be often done by a volunteer, or there are these self-guided ones with some information online. And there's some information to fill out, and it's generally looking at some small steps that you can take to make things better today. So go in a positive direction. I saw some themes that I remember from motivational interviewing within the type of questions that were being asked and the methods that seem to be used. But she also talks about how the single session mindset is important, and that this is essentially two points. One is that something good can come from any one session, and any one session could be the last. So that first part, that something could be gained from a single session, is one thing that is important to keep in mind. And the second part is that any one session could be the last. Sometimes that might be planned, but she talks about the some of the statistics, but in general, often people only go to one session of therapy for a host of reasons. Could be time, financial, but also sometimes people are not sure they want to continue, or getting into issues can feel a bit anxiety provoking or can make people feel uncomfortable. And so they might go away from it and think, oh, I'm okay, or I'm not sure if this is going to help me. But that is true, that it's important to have that mindset, that often we only have one session, or might only become one session. And I try to keep that in mind with clients, because I know that is a possibility. Usually the goal is to have more sessions if I'm seeing a client, but it isn't always going to be the case. So that's the single session mindset. And she also talks about how therapies can be healing and definitely helpful, but that many people have these meaningful moments or quote-unquote turning points with someone who's not a professional, whether it's a peer, maybe it's a stranger. She shares stories of people, for example, in a psychiatric hospital, and someone they interact with says something and it really just hits them a certain way and it leads to some meaningful change. And she doesn't say just that statement alone creates the, you know, fixes the person's problem or cures them forever, but that there are some healing moments or these turning points that can be very significant. And so she's done research and sometimes even just more anecdotal, or she even talks about how some of the observation she's made is not officially research because she might maybe didn't have a huge sample size or people were self-selecting and that they were volunteering the information. But she's looked at some themes that seem to come up that she calls pathways to hope, or things that help people lead to change or can be moments that contribute to their well-being or making some positive changes. So after the break, I'll get into these five themes, or she highlights 16, she says, that she found, but specifically, I should say, highlights five of them in the book, because I think they're also relevant for ways we may make changes in our own life. So after the break, continuing on the book, Little Treatments, Big Effects by Jessica Schleider. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Continuing the discussion on the book, Little Treatments, Big Effects by Jessica Schleider. So I was sharing before the break, she has done a lot of research on these single session interventions, but also looking at moments that have been meaningful for people to create change. And often they do come about in formal clinical settings, but as she shares, very often they are not that. They happen in a university lecture or a brief exchange with a friend or a YouTube video. It doesn't have to be a formal mental health type of a setting. And so compiling some responses from individuals about turning points, what led to significant changes, she realized that it seems that experiencing hope or an increase in hope was very meaningful in most of these types of turning points that people had, something that made them feel that things could get better and possibly would be better in a variety of ways. And she found different themes, 16 of them that emerged, but five of them were particularly common in people's responses. And so I wanted to go through those because I think for any of us, we've probably experienced maybe all of these, but different ones of these in different ways in our life. And it could be important to keep them in mind what might be helpful in creating hope in us and also helping to create some change. So here are these five themes, pathways to hope, that she highlights in the book. So the first one is surprising yourself. And that's doing something, even something small, you were once certain you could not, or something that you didn't think you can do or thought you were unable to do. And this can be very meaningful when you tell yourself, oh, there's no way I can give a talk in front of my class, and then you do. Or there's no way I can face my fear of planes and go on a flight, and you go on a flight and you surprise yourself. This can be really, really meaningful in creating change, because what we often recognize is we don't change not just because we can't, we don't believe we can, but also often we're scared of it too. It could be very intimidating. The lack of control, the change, the unknown can make it scary. So often with clients, I hear them say, I can't do something. Oh, I can't, ask someone on a date. I can't ask for a raise. I can't do these things. And what I try to share with them is one of these cliche therapy type of things, but is that don't say, I can't do that, but I have not done it yet. It's possible I may have not done it, but that's not because you can't do it. It's that you have not taken that risk, that chance to do it. But it's easier to tell ourselves we just can't. You're nervous about applying to this job and you find out they close the applications. I can't apply. There's something comforting in that, even if you might be disappointed as well. And often we go towards that comfort, that we like to tell ourselves something is impossible because it takes leaves us off the hook. Now I don't have to worry about doing that thing that I'm a little bit scared of. So surprising yourself was one of the common themes that came up that led to people becoming more hopeful. So, for example, they did something that they didn't think they could do. They almost accidentally or inadvertently found themselves in a situation, had to do something, and were able to handle it. And they realized, wow, I can handle more than I can. And that's something I've noticed with so many of my clients, getting to see them struggle with something, think about something, and then finally face it and do it. And it's something, another therapy cliche, but that we're all much more powerful and capable than we think we are. That's true for most people. There could be some that err on the other side, but for the majority of people, we're much more powerful than we think we are. We think we can't do something, that we would need someone to do it for us, or someone else can do it, but we can't. And then you end up doing it. You realize, like, oh, it was a limit I was putting on myself. So surprising ourselves, that's a big one. The second one she mentions is feeling seen, experiencing newfound validation from others, feeling genuinely and fully understood. That could be very healing. Of course, to feel seen, often we have to show ourselves, and that could be a hard part too, being vulnerable to be seen. But when we really genuinely feel seen by someone who we think understands us, also especially if we feel like they get us, or maybe they've been through what we've been through at some level, that could be incredibly powerful in giving us hope and making us feel like we're okay. That, you know, often when we're dealing with something, we think we're crazy, something's wrong with us, we're the only one, we're weak, all these things might come up. But when we feel seen, that could be incredibly healing and give us hope. And a big component in therapy is normalizing, validating, empathizing with people in their experiences so they feel seen, because that itself can help us to then make things better even for ourselves. So we can accept what's there, but then even make things better as a result. The third one she mentions out, you know, this is almost sounds like the opposite, but this is seeing others. So the first one is feeling seen. The second one is, feeling seen. The third one is seeing others. Discovering that other people are going through or have overcome struggles similar to yours, feeling less alone and more supported. That word, they're supported. That's why things like support groups can be so meaningful. Being in a room with other people who are going through a similar problem, challenge that you are, than you are, can be very important in making you feel less alone, give you more hope, make you feel like it's not just you that's struggling through this. Even people will often hear about a diagnosis, like, oh, there's a name for the thing I'm going through. And so things aren't black and white. Sometimes the diagnosis can be a label that's feels hurtful to the person, but often knowing that what you're going through has a name can make you feel better. Other people are going through it. It's common enough that they've actually named this thing. It seems to be part of the human experience, a challenge that others go through. That can actually be very helpful for many people. But seeing that other people are going through something that you're going through can be really a hopeful thing. And this is why the internet has definitely made big advancements in this, because generally in your life, you'd be exposed to a small number of people. But when you get exposed to and potentially exposed to the whole world, you can find other people that may be going through something similar to you. And that can be very healing and can lead to hope. The fourth one is reclaiming your narrative, realizing the future you want for yourself and taking your first step toward making that future possible. So reclaiming your narrative, recognizing my story is not finished, but also that I have some sense of control or authorship of my story. That can be very powerful. So if we feel like life is happening to us, then we have to just hope that it happens in a way we want it to be, or that we get lucky. But if we recognize I have some sense of control over things, I have an ability to make things as I want them to be, doesn't mean I have full control. I can control everything, but I can have a huge impact on what my life is going to look like. That can be very powerful. And so reclaiming your narrative can also be the sense, again, of change, in the sense that my story maybe has been a certain way, but it doesn't mean it has to continue to be that way. Just because it's been, I've have struggled with this, or I've had a challenge with this, doesn't mean that has to be the rest of my life. I can reclaim the narrative. I can write a different story, a different ending for myself. And the fifth one is giving back, feeling empowered through supporting others through struggles similar to your own. And so, you know, this can be very healing and helpful and hopeful for us when we give back to others, especially if they're going through something similar than us, but in general makes us feel good. That can be very empowering and make us feel good about ourselves and our own strength and our capacity, but also seeing others can remind us of where we have been or where we are, and having hope for that person gives us hope as well. So I think it's not surprising to see that giving back also can be a very important turning point for many individuals that can lead to more hope and to more change for them. So yeah, the book for me was eye-opening because I did not know much about single session interventions. I do also firmly agree with this notion that big moments, therapeutic moments, or things that are therapeutic don't just happen in a therapy room. They can happen in all parts of life, and moments that might surprise us might end up being very significant and very therapeutic for us. As she said, I don't think, of course, this kind of single session intervention would replace therapy or should. I do think often longer term therapy can be beneficial for many types of issues, deeper issues, also relationship issues. You maybe can give people things to work on that they can then continue to work on, and it might be significant. I'm not saying that single session won't be helpful, but often working through issues, I think, will take more than that. And so the notion isn't let's replace therapy with this or replace medication with this, but that this can be something additionally very helpful. And so I think that's important, something that I want to keep in mind also with my own clients, even in sessions, remembering that single session mindset. It could be the last session, so giving them something that they can take from that. But also, you know, promoting this type of work because there are so many people that could benefit from these interventions. Some of them are self-consultations, as I think they were called, that people can do on their own. And, you know, Dr. Schleider has worked with people to put a lot of these online for free, so you can access them and take a look. A lot of it I saw was directed towards teens, but it's also for any age group, so it's not only for teenagers. But so we see that that can be something that for individuals who maybe have a hard time finding someone, who maybe are embarrassed to seek out someone to see for therapy or where to even look, they can be really helpful to give them some sense of help or some way to get some help to start to help themselves. And so you can look for these. If you look up Jessica Schleider, I'm trying to find the website because she does list places that you can look for these exercises. But if you search her, I'm sure you'll come across these. So again, that's Jessica Schleider is the author of the book. I'm trying to see if I can find where these were listed, because it was somewhere near the back of the book where she has put all the websites that you can find them. But nonetheless, you know, it's eye-opening for me, as I mentioned, to read a book about a type of therapy, a single session therapy that I did not even know about. That's almost, I would say, humbling. I mean, it's a reminder, of course, that I don't know so much, but that I didn't get training in this. That was something I thought was kind of interesting. And I don't know if now, it's been a while since I've been in the, you know, graduate school. That was 2011 when I graduated. I don't know if it's something that people are doing now. But if you go to schleiderlab.org, it seems like that's where you'll be getting a lot of access to things. Schleider is S-C-H-L-E-I-D-E-R, lab.org. And I think as a backslash, yes. But just if you look her up, Dr. Jessica Schleider, I'm sure you'll come across her work. So I think important book for me to read as a therapist. I think if you're a therapist, definitely read this. But also, I think it'd be helpful for anyone to get some more insight into what type of moments can lead to healing, how we can look for them, that healing doesn't have to always be a long-term thing, or at least the start of it. Maybe what sparks it is not long-term. It could be a moment that turns into something big. So the book is Little Treatments, Big Effects by Jessica Schleider. Let's go into our last commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Yesterday I gave a talk to a small group of parents, and the talk was about, I think it was titled, Why It's Good to Feel Bad, which intentionally was supposed to sound like it's not true. Why would it be good to feel bad? But it's a theme that I so often talk about with parents on the air in general, about how important it is to allow our children to not feel okay. That often when you ask parents, what do you want for your child? One of the most common answers is going to be for them to be happy, which I can understand. And especially if we think of happiness as just a smile on the face, feeling good in the moment, I think that can be very problematic if we just focus on feeling good and feeling good in the moment, I mean, we would actually think that's closer to hedonism, just doing whatever feels good, seeking pleasure, seeking fun, avoiding responsibility, discomfort, work, anything that might not feel very good in the moment. That's not a good thing. If we really think about it, we don't want that for our kids. But unfortunately, we sometimes think this way with our kids, or at least react this way with our kids, that we want them to just feel good all the time. Or if they're feeling bad, we think that's a really, really bad thing. But what's so critical is recognizing that life inevitably should feel bad some of the time, or will feel bad some of the time, and that anything meaningful in life will make you feel bad sometimes, or have challenges that won't feel good. And so if we actually want to help our children, rather than focus on making sure they feel good all the time or feel happy, we want to help them learn to tolerate the negative things, the negative feelings, the negative aspects of life when they do inevitably show up. And even actually teach them to go towards the right types of negative feelings, the feelings that don't feel good in the moment, but actually are good for them, just like they are for any of us. And so the parents had great questions. Things came up about, you know, when to say no or how to say no, and things related to that. Because, you know, one thing that also we have to be aware of, I was talking to them of how in order to tolerate our kids' bad feelings, we have to first recognize, can I tolerate my own bad feelings when I don't feel good? And I think for most of us, the answer is we're not very good at dealing with our own bad feelings. So when we feel sad or upset or anxious, what do you do? How well do you tolerate that? And how much do you turn to quick fixes, something to take the feeling away, or try to numb yourself, or try to check out and deny the feeling altogether, which is what most of us do? How good are you at sitting with the feeling, or dealing with the feeling, or doing something that might help, but in a small way, going for a walk, meditating, talking to a friend, rather than trying to quickly get away from that feeling? Because if we can't tolerate our own negative emotions, the ones that don't feel good, we won't be able to tolerate our kids, because seeing them feel it, one, it'll make us feel that feeling, and that makes us feel bad. We'll try to get away from it. And two, we think it's so bad to feel that way that we won't be able to tolerate the thought and the feeling of our kids going through it. So we quickly try to get them to feel good, to cheer up, to give them the toy, the treat, break some rules, even if we have to make them feel okay in the moment, because it feels like that's the only thing that matters. So it's paradoxical, but one of the best things we can do for our kids is to help them to get good at feeling bad and not feeling okay, because that's part of life. And to show them that when you feel bad, it's not a big deal. It doesn't feel good. We don't like it. We don't want it for them. It's not that we want them to feel bad in any given moment, but that we understand it's a part of life, and we also understand they're going to be okay. To give them that hope that this is not a scary thing, this is not something that we have to freak out about, but that this is just part of life, something that we all go through, and we will go through this, and you will get through this too. And this also all relates to things like positive thinking, or thinking positive, or, you know, when we put a phrase that has come out more recently in recent years is toxic positivity, which I think is a really important term, because it does encapsulate very well that this, it does feel like a oxymoron, because positivity sounds good. How could it be toxic? But it can be very toxic when it does several things, including makes us feel bad when we feel bad. So if you're supposed to always be good, and there's this emphasis on positivity and positive mood, no bad days, well, then if you're feeling bad, something is wrong with you, or something is bad about you. It also makes it harder for us to talk about those things when they are there. It can make us feel like we're not supposed to feel that way, that something's wrong there. And it takes away a big part of who we are. And because of that, we become way less authentic and real and genuine with one another when we try to make everything positive, try to make everything have to be a good thing. The book I read a few weeks ago, Night Vision, really addressed this very well, looking at a few of the quote-unquote negative feelings and trying to understand the value in them. Not just in, you need the bad to know the good, but actually that there genuinely is value in them, not in even a romanticizing way, but actually there's something there. So I really appreciated that book, and definitely very aligned with the way I think of this theme, that we shouldn't just look at positive being good and negative being bad. Positive, go towards it. Negative, always run away from it. That's not a good thing. And it also made me think of how, because people are so intolerant of the negative feelings and so much wanting to get away from them, and so much there's praise of positive thinking, and if you feel good about something, you're doing something right, even if you're ignoring your own feelings, even if you're actually manipulating things to get to that type of mindset, it made me recognize that there's a big difference between being positive and not being able to tolerate the negative. So there's a big difference between being positive and not being able to tolerate the negative. Because not in a toxically positive way, I think there is something about being able to see the good in things, not in a disingenuous way, not in only seeing the good things or denying the bad things and having to spin everything into a positive, but there is something to being able to see the good in things, even the beauty in things, even if they are painful, and not to make it good if someone is in pain or try to deny their pain, but we can recognize something there. So I think there's something very important about being able to see the positive. However, most people that are quote unquote very positive, what you might recognize is underneath that is not a genuine positivity. It's actually a fear of the negative, or not being able to tolerate the negative. So those aren't the same thing, because if you are being positive because you can't tolerate the negative, that means that you're going away from something that might be true. You're running away from something. The way I might say this is you're running away from a nightmare rather than chasing a dream. So it's not like you're going towards something you like. You're running away from something that you can't handle. And that actually means that it's not genuinely something that you are feeling, but you're just going away from that. So we have to be aware of this in ourselves and others, this tendency to always find a way to make something look good or feel good because we can't tolerate that bad feeling. That doesn't make us positive people. That makes us denying people, people that are avoiding a significant aspect of life and of experience, which is that sometimes it doesn't feel good. And so coming back to our children, what we hopefully will want for them is to be able to tolerate the things that happen in life. And we intuitively know this too, because every parent I know, and so often I deal with this in families I work with, are trying to get their kids to study more. And so, you know, it's this feeling that, okay, you want to play video games, but you need to study. So get the homework done and then go play video games, or play, you know, less video games and study more. So we get that we are trying to get them to do things that sometimes don't feel as good as something else they can be doing. But often when it comes to experiencing something sad or something stressful, or if they get worried about something, we think we have to just take away their feeling. And I see this so often with people, that there's this tendency to just push people there. And with parents, it could be even more tempting because we care so much about how our kids feel. And also we might feel more control, which you often do have with our kids. We have a lot more power or control over what they go through, what they experience. Even depending on their age, they might look up so much to us to know even what to think in a moment, that we might try to force them to think that it's okay. And, you know, one thing I've noticed is oftentimes there's this tendency to go away from feelings of guilt. And I've heard people say guilt, just like a lot of negative emotions, that people say, oh, that's just a waste of a feeling. Why should you ever feel guilty? Or why should you ever feel regret or some other feelings that don't feel good? And I can get where people are coming from, but actually, when you think of someone who doesn't experience guilt, that's actually someone who has antisocial personality disorder, or we might call a psychopath. Someone who doesn't feel bad about things or guilty about things, that's not a good thing. So if we think guilt is a wasteful feeling, absolutely not. It's a good feeling to have in a healthy way. Of course, if you feel guilty about things that are not your responsibility, that definitely could be problematic. So like all emotions and feelings that we can experience, it doesn't mean they're always right or they're always going to be in a healthy degree, but to have no guilt is not a goal at all, and you should definitely not want that for yourself or for your children. So as hard as it could be to sit with, if your child does something hurtful to someone and then says, I feel bad about it, Now, we don't want to heap the guilt, or definitely don't want to make shame be a part of their experience. I am bad. But if they did something bad or hurtful to someone else, it actually is very helpful to recognize that and actually even praise them for feeling guilty, in the sense that we're saying, yeah, I could see how you don't feel good about that thing that you did. What do you think that person felt, let's say, if they did something to someone else? And sit with it. Now, we don't want to make them feel even worse. As I said, make sure they're not becoming shameful and thinking that means I'm a bad person. We can make it clear that all people make mistakes and do things at times that aren't good or might hurt someone else. It's what we try to learn from them. And also, can we make it right? So also, if we avoid the guilt, we also avoid reconciliation. So if your child did something hurtful to someone else, and you just think, okay, I just want my kid to feel guilty. So no, it's okay. Oh, it doesn't matter. Maybe they didn't even hear it. Maybe that kid is sensitive. They got upset, coming up with excuses to justify it. To me, that's very harmful to your child's development and actually becoming a good, strong, decent human being who cares about individuals, has empathy, recognizes the consequences of their actions, recognizes that they should have care for other people, that other people feel the way that they feel. That's a very important thing. So it's more to sit with that guilt and be like, okay, you don't feel good. And now what do we do with this feeling of not feeling good? First, yeah, over time, forgiving yourself too, if it feels that way. But can you go talk to that person that you hurt? How can we try to make things right? We can't take away what we did, but we can try to make things at least better and come to a resolution that feels better for us and also feels better for them. So, looking at emotions as wasteful, definitely that becomes wasteful because we're wasting very important information that is something that we're being given by our brain and our body. And when our children are going through it, we're actually harming them tremendously if we try to take away these feelings just on the basis of, well, it doesn't feel good and I don't want my child not to feel good. So if your child doesn't care at all what people think, that's another thing people try to teach their kids. Yes, do most people care too much about what people think? Absolutely. And that's why we have these notions of don't care what people think. But you need to care about what people think if you're going to be a citizen amongst others in society. You have to have some level of care about what people think. Yes, if you're letting people make the decisions for you, well, I won't do this because other people won't like it, or I won't wear this shirt that I like, or I won't pick this career, that's definitely something. So how much? Yes. But should you care at all? Of course. That's just part of being a human being, that we should care. Again, you would be raising a psychopath if you raise someone who doesn't care at all what anyone ever thinks. There's different contexts where it matters more. Let's say how you treat others and how they respond, that matters a lot what they think. How you live your life? No, that should be something that is up to you. I mentioned The Courage to be Disliked. I love the title of that book, and I love that as a theme, that if you are living your life authentically and genuinely with no intention to harm someone else, but people don't like it or they have a reaction to it, that's great. You should still do that. You should tolerate that being disliked, but not that you shouldn't care what anyone thinks. That's not something we would want. So I enjoyed speaking with the parents. It was interactive, so I got to hear their thoughts. So as always, I learn from them as I hopefully give them something. But these themes of tolerating your children feeling not okay is very hard. And a big one there that we also talked about yesterday is that if you want to keep appropriate boundaries, structures, help your kids grow, you often have to tolerate them being mad at you. So there can feel like a big difference between, oh, my child has heard about something that happened at school with a teacher or another student, and a very different thing from my child is mad at me or upset with me. And our intention, of course, should never be to harm our children in any kind of way. The intention is never that. But we do have to be willing to accept that if we want to be genuine with them, real with them, and to help them to become the best versions of themselves in all ways, we at times will do things that they don't like. We might set a boundary when they don't want the boundary to be there. We might let them know that we're having a certain feeling about something that's going on, that we have to let them know what's happening. Whatever it might be, there are things that inevitably will lead to our children being upset with us. Not our intention, but it is part of any relationship, is conflict and tension has to be there. And so as a parent, you have to also ask yourself, how good am I at tolerating that? Not just my child feeling bad in general, which is challenging for most parents, but also especially how do I handle if they're upset with me, if they're not feeling good with me? A very big challenge, very much easier said than done, but to really, I think, be a healthy and strong parent, we have to be able to tolerate our children not being okay with us. We don't intend to do it, but it has to be part of any relationship that we can tolerate them being upset with us. So that can be the hardest feeling to tolerate, but one that is definitely very necessary. All right, that brings us to the end of tonight's show. A big thank you to Farhuda here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Fadi Dolakwi. Zan Zendegi Azadi.